and live around the world, this is Paper Cuts with Brad and Jay.
We'll just get this out of the way here. Thanks for joining us on Brad's show.
Yeah, thanks for coming to my show.
I did not say shenanigans.
Okay.
Are you drinking already?
No, I've just got water. Just got water. Always looking smooth, aren't you?
Yeah, I do. I try to clean it out for the show. Look, one of us has to. Come on.
Joining us this evening, Stoker Award winner E.V. Knight.
We are live.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for stopping by. Totally appreciate Paper Cuts. My name is Jay. That's Brad over there. Enough with us. You already know about us. You already know about us. We have a special guest this evening. I don't know how we landed this guest. We owe some people some money somewhere. But it's not every day when we get a Stoker. And I was told I need to be on my best behavior. So we'll see how that goes.
Why?
The people that we owe money to. They said that.
Oh.
Writer of The Fourth Whore, Children of Demeter, in her newest. So everybody hold it up at the same time. 3 Days in the Pink Tower, just to name a few. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thank you.
What's going on, Evie?
Nothing. I'm just hanging out with you guys tonight.
It's a Friday night. What are you normally doing on a Friday night besides hanging out with dope microphones?
Either at a Savannah Bananas game or I'm working in my real life job.
You were just telling us off the air about Savannah.
Yeah,
exactly what that is.
So it's a local baseball team in Savannah, Georgia. They were a part of the Coastal Plain League. In fact, they just won the championship for the Coastal Plain League. And nice. They also do a world tour throughout the United States, playing what they've invented, banana ball, which is a shortened form of baseball with all kinds of crazy rules. Like you don't walk, you don't get walked. You actually have to sprint to the first base, and you can steal first base. And like if a foul ball gets caught by an audience member, you are out. And so they got all kinds of crazy rules, and they do all kinds of fun things between innings. And they have like the dad bod cheerleading squad, and they have the banana nanas, which are the dancing grandmas, and they have a really fun dancing first base coach, and all the guys that play do fun tricks, and they dance in the middle of an inning, and they're just really, really fun to watch. And they get compared to like the Harlem Globetrotters a lot. So they're like the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball. And ESPN, anyways, is doing a documentary series on them and is at their game tonight. They're playing like as we speak. And so they're playing their game live on ESPN2. And then after that, I believe, or before it, I'm not sure because of a rain issues, they're going to play the first episode of the documentary that we did.
So you could have been there, but you chose to be here with us instead.
Supposed to be here with us.
Yeah, right. So, exactly.
It sounds like one way to get people interested if they're not too interested in baseball and if they think it's too boring.
Yeah.
It's like a whole different world of baseball, a different take on baseball.
Exactly. And that's what they say too, that baseball is boring. And so they're like, we're going to make it fun. And they do. And they sell out like, it's tickets because it's crazy. It's sold out. Every game is sold out.
It reminds me of remember the basketball movie where they mix basketball and baseball together? It kind of reminds me of that a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. Kind of like that. I mean, they do all kinds of fun, crazy stuff. So,
so
and my husband is a manana. He's a dad bod cheerleader. So he's there.
Right. Nice. There's got to be a video of that. There's gonna be a video of that somewhere.
There is, for sure. There is.
So, being in Savannah, Georgia, I've always heard that Savannah is a like a haunted city. Is there a truth about that? Or do you go around looking for ghosts, or you see ghosts? How did they get that name? Not that you created Savannah, but I mean, you're aware of the of the talk of Savannah being a haunted city.
Well, it's been there for a very long time, and unfortunately, it's got quite a sordid history with, you know, slave trading and things like that. So there's a lot of you know, it's been there from pretty much the start, and so lots and lots of history, lots of unfortunately, lots of deaths, and lots of like Civil War went through. And Sherman actually loved the city so much that he didn't burn it down. And because he loved the city so much. But yeah, lots of like typhoid and cholera and all sorts of stuff like that. And a lot of the houses are still very old. And so lots of stories, you know. And then, you know, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, that book and movie, that happened in Savannah. So that house is right downtown, the Mercer Williams house, which is a super cool house. I mean, just beautiful, beautiful old homes and a lot of antebellum and culture and history. So lots of tragic deaths and pain and things like that. And then you also have the Gullah Geechee culture, which is sort of the low country version of, I guess, voodoo. I'm probably, someone will tell me, no, that's not. But, you know, it's like root magic and all kinds of cool, like, mysticism and stuff from the African religions that have come in and brought this really, like, interesting, fascinating culture with them. And so there's that as well. And if you go to, like, Bonaventure Cemetery, which is the big, you know, the big famous cemetery in Savannah, sometimes you'll see the trappings of root work. Like you'll see little things left on graves. And if you are in the know, and the only reason I'm in the know is because I've done enough tours and listened to a lot of like history lectures and things on Savannah, you can sometimes pick it out, like, oh, there was root work done here, you know, because they'll leave different like items and things like that. So yeah, super fun. And I did a an all-night haunted theater tour one time. They do down there, there's lots of like ghost hunters and things like that. And so I did an all-night cemetery or haunted theater tour, which was really cool. Bram Stoker, go ahead.
I was like, did you see any ghosts there or anything? Did you experience anything?
No, I mean, there were a couple like noises we heard, and a couple of times you'd feel like the cold draft come through, but we didn't see anything. So I have yet to see a ghost, and I'm dying to. I really want to. So I'm always like out like doing stuff like that, signing up for the haunts and the tours, because like just one of these times I want to see one. So.
When you go into tours, I'm guessing they're guided tours, possibly. Do they do what you see sometimes on the paranormal shows where like, hey, there's an orb, or listen to that sound and go back and listen to it? You know, a lot of it's kind of made up. But
some
are they pointing things out for you?
Some do, and it depends. Like, you know, there's real touristy tours, and then the tour that I did with the haunted theater, their group is called Proof and Evidence Tour, and so they actually work really hard to debunk everything that they get, and they only like post anything that they really truly cannot bunk, and they'll go back several times and try different angles and stuff. So that one for me was the best one, and I want to go back and do more with them, because I really felt like they were in it for the right reasons and really there to actually learn and see something. And they knew a lot of the history. So I really enjoyed that one, and would recommend Proof and Evidence Tours to anybody that wants to come down to Savannah and do some ghost hunting.
Do you believe in ghosts, or do you have to see it to believe it kind of thing? Because that's how I am.
I really want to believe in them. But yeah, I got to see it, because I don't buy the orbs and the cold spot. You know what I mean? Like, that's just not enough for me. Like, if I see it with my own eyes, then I feel like I'll believe it. So I need to see one.
Like, I watch all these ghost hunting shows, but I'm like, you know, they could fake all that because it's TV.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's so interesting to watch, because like, maybe it's real, maybe it's not, but I have to see it. And then I'm like, oh, then I believe.
yes, I need to see something. And I've done lots of, like, I've done lots of overnight tours all over the place because I just I really want to see one. So
I find it interesting that there are groups that their only job is to debunk it all. You know,
right.
So it's like the non-believers. They don't want you to believe. So it's their job to debunk everything for you.
And exactly.
Like, come on, why you gotta be so negative? Allow me to have my thing here. You know.
Yeah. Like I like that one. I really believe.
Yeah.
In it,
yeah.
Is there one specific place in Savannah that would be like your top ghost hunting experience place you'd want to go to and investigate?
I would love to get into the Mercer Williams house just because I absolutely love the book and the movie. And I really want to get in there. But it's Jim Williams' sister that owns it now. And they do tours, but they do not talk about that. They don't talk about ghosts. They don't talk about it. No, you can't even ask about it. If you ask about it, they say, we don't talk about that here. And it's really just a tour of the house, like in its history and its architecture. So it would be really cool, I think, to get in there.
But you know, people are doing that tour wanting to know about the ghost.
That's why half of them
like
sign
kid,
up.
Like, you know, I gotta ask, you know.
Yeah.
I'd be kicked out right away.
I'm sure they get sick of it. Right. I would too. So yeah. I heard that right away when I got there. And so I haven't done the tour yet because I can't go in there and just like not ask about it.
I wonder why they do that. If they're trying to distance themselves. Maybe they don't believe and they're trying to distance themselves from it, maybe.
I can imagine it was, you know, with the book and the movie and everything, it's such a, you know, his sister is probably just so tired of all that. And that, you know, it really was somebody, you know, it was somebody's brother, it was somebody's, you know, family. So it's probably feels disrespectful to have that in your face all the time. So I understand where she's coming from for sure. But.
Mm-hmm. So what does living in a city like this that's haunted, that has a history, does that do anything for you when it comes time to write?
Oh, absolutely.
Are you being channeled through some of this history and it's going into your writing?
Yeah, I really want it to. Like, so a goal of mine that I just haven't been able, I really want to do like a gothic ghost sort of story and like this southern gothic feel. Absolutely love it. And reading it. And I haven't mastered it yet. So I'm thinking, I'm going to do it. Like I'm waiting to find like my inspiration, you know, so I'm always looking for something to spark and say, this is the story. Because it's just, I haven't tackled the ghost story yet. And I love the Southern Gothic feel of things. So I really love to do one sometime. So I'm always looking, I haven't found it yet.
Yeah, I love the Southern Gothic stuff. I'm like Anne Rice is a big one, but I've never read her stuff yet. So she's one like at the top of my list I need to read.
Yeah, she's great. I love her stuff.
We'll just hold you to it. So your next one is going to be the Southern Gothic.
Okay. All right. Great. No pressure.
Well, Aaron T's in our email together that you were working on a kind of a Dracula, Bram Stoker Dracula inspired book.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, please don't make me do something else. Like every time I try to finish that book, something else comes up and it's all good stuff. You know what I mean? I can't complain. But yeah, I'm doing a sort of a rewrite, kind of a Dracula, only with a more feminist bent to it, with a look at like hysteria and blood in the womb and that whole thing. And then just women in general having a bigger part in it, because I really feel like Mina really was the hero of the book. You know, when you look at that group of vampire fighters, she really was kind of like the, you know, if it weren't for her, they would never have found him. They would never have won in the end. So, but I feel like because of the time and the era that she kind of her role got a little suppressed and the men become the hero and she becomes this damsel in distress. And so I wanted to kind of play with that idea and, you know, change Renfield into a female and let Renfield and Mina kind of work together and kind of play it that way and sort of present it as sort of found footage that was repressed by the publisher that wouldn't allow it to be published because in the time it for women to
be. I read Dracula. Yeah, I read Dracula for the first time earlier this year, and like Mina's the one figuring everything out, and they're like, "Oh, it's too much. You can't handle it. You guys sit back and go rest, and we'll go handle it." And she's like, "But she's the one that knows everything."
Exactly. That's it. The whole time, and they just everybody's like, "Oh no, no, no!" And then you know, she's telling them to go under hypnosis and telling them and leading them to write to him, and they're like, "Oh, we have to protect her."
Would you look at it as more doing like a different point of view, or just a totally retelling of it?
Kind of a different point of view, almost as if. So I was approaching it as if first of all, I changed the films and kind of her a backstory that was sort of like all this other, you know, in Dracula, it had the safe with all of their journals and all stuff in it that Mina put all together, right? The idea is that there was a separate safe with these things that were taken out of the book. This information was put out because it, in that time, women couldn't be that. So it's almost like they had to quickly rewrite Renfield. And that's why there's not really a good, Renfield seems like a plot hole a little bit in Dracula because you never really understand, like, did he know Dracula before? Like, how do they have this connection and where is he from and who is this guy? And so I kind of wrote it to fill these plot holes to it, explain why the ending doesn't make sense because, you know, all of a sudden you can stab somebody with a knife and then it just like there's so many things that didn't, like it's almost like he dropped the ball at the end. Like, and I was trying to explain it away as if he was under pressure from to sort of quickly change things so that women weren't the heroes. It had to be the men, you know, because no one would accept that. And so so it's kind of like found footage, missing parts of Dracula or something is kind of how I'm trying to do it. But it's taking a lot more effort than I thought it was going to.
Have you been working on that one for a while then?
I've been working on it for like 2 years.
Okay.
I find it funny that... You know, when people are complaining like about books with plot holes or when they review it, you know, you could always say, plot holes went back to Dracula. That was like the beginning of plot holes, you know? So that's like one way to look at, you know, when people are harsh on other people's books and stuff. Like, yeah.
Yes, Dracula is full of plot holes, and yet it's second only to the Bible in sales and distribution. It's taken a while, and then I took a break from it to write The Pink Tower. So I'm kind of just getting back into it again. But yeah, I went to Philadelphia. I looked at Bram Stoker's original notes. I got to go to the Rosenbach Museum, and like they pulled all his actual handwritten notes for Dracula out, and like got to look at them and try to really get in his head and figure out, you know, what he was doing too, trying to. That was awesome. It was really cool. Yep. Anybody can do it. You just have to, you make an appointment and tell them you want to go and why, you know, if you're working on something, a project or whatever, and you just make an appointment and go and they'll pull them all out for you. It's really awesome.
So you've been working on that for a while and you took a break and that's when you started writing
your latest.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that seems like a very big shift in a mindset. You're going down the Dracula road and then this is not Dracula.
No. So that this past June was the 30th anniversary of the incident. And and it was coming up and it was just on my mind a lot. And I'd always thought about doing something with it, you know, writing something just to kind of get it out of me. And it was coming and I was like, you know what, I can't get it out of my head. It's time to maybe put everything else aside and just purge this. And so I spent about 3 or 4 months just kind of focusing on my story and how I wanted to retell it. And so
And for people that don't know, what is this about a little bit?
So it is, we're calling it like auto fiction or speculative nonfiction.
Speculative auto fiction.
Yeah. So yeah, it's based on when I was 17, I was kidnapped from my home at gunpoint by two men I didn't know and taken away to a hunting cabin in the woods where I was raped back and forth by them. And so it really, you know, it changed. It was the summer right before my senior year of high school. So it really affected me in so many ways and made me, I think, a lot of what I am today because of what happened, both good and bad things. And, you know, like I said, the 30th anniversary is coming up on it. And it's always something that's there. Like there's the box of papers and stuff and the clippings from the newspaper and the all the things from the police department and all the interactions in the court that I had and all my letters and things that I just have to like purge it and let it go. It come up, I wanted to do something with it. I don't want to write a memoir. I don't want to like my story. It just seemed like, what was the point of doing that? Like so many people share their story, and what made mine any different or any more special? And so I thought, well, I'm a horror writer, so what could I? Maybe I could write something and really like sort of change the ending and get, you know, come out feeling better about it. Like put my own closure to it. And so that's what I tried to do, and that's what I did. I guess I don't know if I was successful, but
what's really interesting about this particular story. Most people, if they go through that incident, they kind of make like an autobiography, and it's a factual, you know, this is the history. But you chose a path to, it's more of in a fictional novella way, where it's names and faces may have been changed or places may have been changed, whatever the case may be. It's a different road that you went down with to tell the story. Whereas, you know, a lot of people would probably go with the biography or the autobiography way. So, I mean, what did you just want to be different? You didn't want to do an autobiography or so what made you decide to go down this road?
Well, so like I said, I write fiction, you know, so.
Right.
I've never written anything nonfiction, anything substantial, anyways. You know, this is an essay or something. So, I was playing around with that. Like, could I make a whole new story? And then it felt weird too, because I was sort of take it in like a fully fictionalized story. Didn't feel right either. And I started thinking about it, and I was like, you know what? This is my story. This is what happened to me, and it belongs to me, and I can do whatever I want with it. And I'm gonna paint it purple and gold, and you know, throw glitter. I can do that, and if I want to edit it differently, I can do that because it's my story. And then the more I thought about that, I was like, yeah, you know what? I wanna see, one, could I do it, and two, you know, could I do it in a way that would inspire maybe other survivors or victims that, you know, realize that it is your story. Like, it is your story. This happened to you. You own it. It's yours. Do whatever you want with it. And see, look, you can do whatever you want with it. And end it however you want. Bring it, you know, make your own closure. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. And I was pretty happy with the way that it worked out. And so hopefully it's inspiring in that way.
It is inspiring that way. I like the fact that you're saying, make the ending the way you want it. I mean, you know, you somewhat become a superhero that way, in a way, you know, it's like, if it's such a sad ending, let's make it the good way. So yeah, that is a very inspiring ending.
You know, especially with rape, is about pain and controlling somebody, and to be able to take that control back and be like, no, you don't get to decide how my story ends. I get to decide how my story ends. And so, so that's what I really wanted to do with it. Like, okay, all right, let's do it this way. And,
do you think it was harder or easier for you to write it in sort of this fictionalized format instead of doing it like what Jay said, like a non-fiction, like autobiography way?
There was it was probably a little bit harder, I think, because there was a few times where I had to step back and tell myself, okay, I am not Josie. It's, or I would say to my husband, like, God, I feel like I'm lying. Like I'm embellishing my story with this stuff, this, and he's like, it's not your story. It's Josie's story. And I was like, oh yeah, you're right. And so
that's key too. That's something I had to remind myself to read that to separate the two. So,
and that's what he kept saying. He's like, it's based on your story, but she isn't you, and you put her there and she's going to be okay. And it was just like, it was really inspiring too, to have him say that, like you get to be like in the beginning, I say, you get to be the creator. You are the high priestess of this. So he's like, you get to be the universe sending her messages. So you get to step away and let her, experience it and let her come out okay. You're going to make sure she's okay. And so once I realized that was kind of it, I became sort of the universe on the outside, sort of guiding her. Then it became a lot easier because it was just a matter of saying, this isn't exactly my story. It's inspired by my story. There's a lot of truth in it, unfortunately, but certainly not my actual story. And so being able to step back and say, I'm just going to be Josie's guide through this and get her out of it. It was a lot easier once I came to that mindset and that realization.
Was it as cathartic as you were maybe hoping it would be or thinking it would be once you were completely done with it?
Yeah, I was, playing around with the end scene, for some time with that. And, I just wanted to be done with, I wanted it to be over when it was over and like not what really happened, which was, my entire senior year spent in a courtroom and in trials and in, retelling it and having lawyers, question everything you did. And, I wanted it to end and walk and just sort of like that whole, that slow motion hero walking away from the explosion and stuff that you left behind. And that's how I wanted it to be. And, so I was super happy with how it worked out, like the sort of that idea of walking into, the woods, knowing that it's still the woods of like, I talk about it being sort of like a fairy tale woods, like, and sort of walking into it, knowing there's going to be a lot of scary stuff still to walk through, but walking away from it.
I think this may be my first story that I've read that is based on true events. I mean, I've seen a lot of movies, because sometimes we'll have like the disclaimer in the beginning, inspired by true events. But as far as books go, because I mean, a lot of times with books, it's fiction or nonfiction,
Right.
So you don't always see that. So I mean, I really appreciate the direction it went and how it's, inspired by true events. But like you were saying, you and Josie are two different people. And again, I reminded myself that at least four times throughout the story, because I was trying to come up with some questions for this show and I was like, okay, but I have to remember, this is a character she created too. So,
I remember we were talking about it at the very end of last week with Brendan. You just said it pissed you off while you're reading it.
I'm a father of two girls, I'm a father of two little girls. So there are several parts that piss me off getting through it, but but it's a story that I feel once you get into it and you read it, it's a story that needs to be told, So
So a lot of the dialogue, unfortunately, is directly from court documents and statements and things like that. So a lot of the things that they said in the book are really actual things that they said to me, or they said to each other. And so, yeah, there's a lot to get angry about.
Yeah. There was something you said in the author's note about how you were, you contacted like the records place or wherever, and they wouldn't give you your own records. No. And that just was like, why? That's ridiculous.
I know. I was so mad. I was like, I'm putting this in there. I'm gonna call you out, Pennsylvania. Because
I feel like since the records are about you, I don't know. That just was like blowing my mind. Like they wouldn't give you your own stuff.
Yeah. I should have published the letter they sent. Cause it was like, while we sympathize with what you're saying, because I told, you know, I explained everything. I gave them like all this information that I had. I was like, I just want, you know, their statements when they were arrested. I want my statements. I want all of that. And it's closed case. You know, it went to trial. They were found guilty. They did their time in jail. So I don't understand why why they couldn't send that to me, but they
usually
that
stuff's like public information, right?
I wonder if it was because you're a minor at the time, maybe.
That's the only thing I could think of, like maybe that, I don't know. But yeah, they knew it was me. I mean, I gave them everything, you know, and they were just like, yeah, sorry. We sympathize with, we understand what you're saying, you know? And, but we can't release any of it. And I suppose, you know, I could have fought it. You know, I see shows all the time where people they get the no, and then they go back and they get a lawyer and they fight it. But I was like, you know what? I have enough. I think I can do this. And so I was just like, enough. Cause it took 3 months for them to get that letter back to me. I was like, not wasting any more time on this. Like, I really want to get to it. So
you get a lawyer, then you start getting the money wrapped up into it, and it just starts spiraling out of control. It's just making something that should have been short, like drawn out, you know. Now you have an attorney, and now 6 months down the line, we might be able to get your stuff now, you know, and it's just.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It wasn't worth it to me. I had, like I said, I had copies of my statement and my mother's statement that were made. And I had, then when they came up for parole, I got to do my victim's impact statement. So I had those from like the 5 year mark, the 7 year mark, the 10 year mark, because they'll type them up and send them to you for approval, before they release it to the parole board. So I had those, and I was like, you know what, this is enough. This was my story anyway. So I said this, you know, the day after it happened, this is what I said, you know, 6 months after it happened, this is what I said. So I had my story, and that's all that mattered to me. So
when you were writing this, was it always a conscious thing that you were going to release it out for the public, or did it start out you're just writing it for yourself and it turned into a story you might want to release? Because I was talking to Aaron about it, and I was like, if something ever like that happened to me, like, I would not want anybody to know. Like, I might write it, but I wouldn't want anybody to see it. It'll never see the light of day.
Right. I think if you'd asked me that question when I was 20, 22, 20, had I done it then, I would agree with you. I didn't want anyone to know. Like, it was a terrible thing enough to go back to school my senior year, because it's high school and everybody has the rumors were rampant and it was ridiculous. Right. So that was hard enough. I didn't want to talk about it to people. But now I wanted to write it for public consumption because, again, what they did, like you said, it's rage inducing. The way that, you know, the whole thing is rage inducing, and the trials and stuff. I didn't know where I was going to end it. You know, would I go to the end of the trial stuff? Cause that is a whole nother level of exasperation. But no, I wanted it out there because once I was done with it, once I had it the way I wanted it, I was like, yes, I want this out there because I want people who feel that way. Like, no, I don't want to share this. I don't want anybody to know that you don't have to share it. You know, you can do what you, like I said, you can do what you want with it. Right. You can make it your own, and whatever way to make it better for you, or to make it easier for you to, to live with what happened, you can do that. So I thought, no, I really like that message, and I wanted to put it out there for anyone who's ever been through anything similar.
Did you ever think, or have you gotten any kind of backlash, or did you think you were getting any kind of backlash for making the story this way as opposed to a nonfiction from maybe others who have you know, went through sexual assault, and mm-hmm. you know, they may look at it as, okay, well, she's kind of
exploitative, maybe, kind of,
yes, mm-hmm. you know, making it for mm-hmm. like an entertainment way mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. they're not. I mean, were you afraid of any kind of did that ever go even pop in your head?
First, it did. Okay. It did. And, you know, there's been several people like that have put out books that are memoirs or nonfiction, supposedly. And then right. they find mm-hmm. out later that, you know, I think Oprah had several that were in her book club that ultimately ended up being like all lies. They found out like nothing that they said. So I was I was worried about that. But at the same time, I was like, no, I put this author's note in. Like, I'm being right up front from the very start that this is a speculative realism in my own life. There might be some, but I didn't know, like, I didn't know if these two men are, I don't know where they are. I don't know if they'll read it ever or see it or somehow find out. And like, would they, that was something I thought, would they be mad? Because and I was like, you know what? I don't care. I don't care. It's like, yeah, they did it.
Really?
They were found guilty.
Like, their feelings would be the last thing I would be worried about.
Yeah, I don't care. But no, I just felt like, yeah. I just saw somebody post difficult stories are important to share. So yeah, I just felt like, it was, you know, yes, the uncomfortable stories are the most important stories for people to hear. Thank you. Yeah, I think so. I think it's important to the, especially in now, right? Like now with like coming out of the Me Too movement and now the reversal mm-hmm. of Roe v. Wade, I think it's really important for anyone who's been traumatized to be able to tell their story and tell it in whatever way works for you. I mean, it's your, again, the whole idea is that take ownership of your story and make it your own. You know, you don't have to be afraid of it. You don't have to hide behind anything. It's yours and you do with what you want. Mm-hmm. And what's right for me is not necessarily right for anybody else. You know, maybe you want to write it and then burn it in a burn, you know, a burn pit and just, you know, uh-huh. dance around the flames. And that's okay too, because that's the right
you
thing
said that
for
in
you.
There too,
if that's,
yeah.
what, if that's I, right. Dance naked around and drink some Everclear. Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
That's the right thing to do. Right? That's so important to share it, to say that's the message of the author. And
was it?
People will or will not like it, but that's okay.
Was it hard to find a publisher for this, or did you, was it Creature Publishing? Is that what it is? Was it pretty easy to get them on board?
Mm-hmm. It's a Creature. Yeah.
I talked to them about another project, not long before, and had read some of their authors. And so I wanted to work with them. The other project didn't work out for us to work together.
Oh, did we lose her?
We lost her. Let's see if she comes back.
Sorry, everybody that's watching. We've had some technical difficulties this evening. But it happens. I mean, that's what happens. You know, we are the best live show.
Best live show.
I'm trying to boost this up some.
I think she's coming back in.
Okay.
Are you there?
We got her back?
I don't know. Yeah, okay. So, I don't know.
Any excuse, dancing naked and drinking Everclear is a good excuse.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, so I don't know how much if I missed it, but Yeah, they. I just said this is what I'm thinking about doing. I've been wanting to do it, and the 30th anniversary is coming up, and I really want to do this project. Are you interested at all in that? And they were like, absolutely, write it. Let's see it. So it worked out really well that I didn't have to go looking or shopping it around. Like, I knew I wanted to work with a feminist horror publisher. I liked the stuff they were putting out, and so they felt absolutely right for this. And so that's who I went to immediately.
So where did the whole idea of incorporating the tarot cards in come from?
So originally I was dabbling back and forth with tarot or different goddesses, sort of buying her like the whole idea of the triple goddess, the mother, maiden, crone. And and I had talked to a couple of my friends who are really into the occult and in mysticism. And I was asking about like, what symbols do you think I could put in? And, you know, I really want to, and someone said, you should look at tarot for symbols. If you're looking at symbolism, you should look at tarot because you can take symbols off the cards and put into the, you know, in the environment and stuff. And, and so I did look at the cards and then you know, we can incorporate this whole spread and kind of living that spread out and then sort of interpreting each card as it has the message from that card and sort of using that to guide her through the trauma. And all of a sudden that seemed the more right thing to do. And so I kept the black dog. I kept Hecate's black dog because she was going to be a main goddess in it, and I couldn't get rid of the dog, and so I kept her dog. But other than that, Hecate had to go, and Artemis, Diana, the deer, the stag. So I kept some of their stuff, so they're kind of still in there, and I just used them sort of as players, almost as characters too, and then use the tarot to guide her through the process.
So was this the first time you ever messed with tarot cards and done anything with them? So you don't have a history with them?
I love tarot art. I love the art of tarot. I love all the different decks and how each different artist interprets the meanings. And I really I'd love to learn how to do it. I just have never sat down and really done a lot of, like, I haven't learned it well enough. But I was actually had just looked at Sasha Graham's book, and I quote her in my book, The Magic of Tarot, because the whole idea that she teaches in that book is that it's storytelling. It's looking at the cards instead of memorizing the meaning of the cards. It's looking at the cards in that moment and what it means to you, and looking at the symbols on the cards. And then, you know, and I was like, oh yeah, that's, of course, it's storytelling. It's exactly what I'm trying to do. And so, yeah, then all I had to do was try to figure out what her spread was going to be, which was weird because it was like working backwards, right? Instead of getting your spread and then looking at the future, I had to take her story and find the spread that would tell that. So that one took a little bit of work trying to put together a spread that would meet my story criteria. But I don't know. I don't read tarot. I wish I did, but I love the art. I collect decks because of the art. And someday maybe I'll learn it, but.
Well, surprise, because backstage we have someone. I'm kidding. we have a card reader backstage.
Oh,
we're doing it live on the air right now.
Oh my god.
We are going to play. We're going to play a game in a little bit, some tarot card trivia, and see how well we do.
See how well.
I did like the tarot cards in there because it lent this sort of fantasy kind of aspect to this really intense, heavy read. So it was a little bit of levity before diving back into the all the heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought so. I thought it was a nice way to sort of, I don't know, symbolically tell the story at the same time. So.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was also sort of a way for her to kind of escape into her own head a bit.
Right. To dissociate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is what I say all the time, like as a victim of these sorts of things, it's really what happens. It's almost like your soul sort of dissociates. Your soul just kind of curls up in a ball and hides away inside of you. And then your body just mechanically takes over. It's your survival instinct. Your very primitive brain that takes over and does, you know, and I always hate it when rape victims get asked things like, well, why didn't you do this? And why didn't you try to do this? Or even domestic violence, like any victim of trauma, like, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do it? Right. I don't know. I can't answer it. I don't know why. All I know is that I was doing what seemed to be the right thing in the moment to survive. And that's because that's what our bodies biologically are built to do.
Right.
They're not meant to help, you know, for you to think through it. They're just meant to act, because we are living creatures. That's our drive. And so it was a way for her sort of to curl up in that ball and have something to do while her body does whatever it needed to do.
Yeah. It's always easy for someone who's not in a situation to ask questions. Why did you do this and that? So
people love to do that too, don't they?
Right.
Like they love to do it.
Because there was a few moments in here, it's like, oh, that would be a perfect opportunity for her to run away. But that's easy for me to say, sitting in this chair reading this book.
Yeah.
With not actually being in that situation, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you just don't.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask if she wanted to go ahead and read a snippet of it, or.
I'd be happy to.
Did you pick a part out for us? Did you?
I did. I picked it today, in fact.
Okay. Show prep.
Totally. Yeah. Well, because I've been reading, I've done a few readings so far, and I wanted to do a different one because I'm kind of tired of reading the same stuff. So I just picked a part in the middle. So I'll give a little, this is sort of on the way to the cabin, the pink tower, getting close to it. So in the car with the two kidnappers. So, okay. Trying to get the best light. The scenery has lost all semblance of familiarity. Somehow, even the oaks, pines, and poplars all look foreign, menacing. I think of the Grimm Brothers fairy tales my grandma used to read to me, when the main character realizes that the woods they are in no longer look the same. The trees take on a sentience and create a sense of danger for the protagonist, usually a child or a young woman like me. It means you can soon expect to meet the villain. I've certainly gone beyond the borders of safety, of a forest filled with bunnies and songbirds. Here is where you'll find the glowing eyes of lurking predators, the haunted calls of carnivorous birds, brittle twigs snapped by unseen things. Here, in these woods, we will come upon the witch's cottage, where the real story begins. All that's happened up to this point was just preamble, setting the stage for what is to become of me. Slither is driving much too fast for the gravel-covered roads. Oh God, watch out, I yell. A dog, the size of a bear, stands in the center of a split in the road. The beast is like a behemoth version of the prize I won a million years ago, back when I was strong enough to conquer my fears, back before I regressed to this childlike mouse pulled against a gunman in the back of a maroon mechanical prison in the middle of an evil enchanted forest. Slither doesn't seem to see it, but the dog sees me. I know it does. It's crazy to think the dog can see through the car and into the back seat. It seems even further unlikely that we could make eye contact, but I swear we do. Flattop stabs me in the side with his elbow. What are you screaming about? I look at him. How can he not see? The dog. I point, but there is no dog on the road anymore. It must have run off. There was a dog, a big, big dog in the road. We almost hit it. The noise comes from Flattop in an awful, honking, braying laugh that I've heard in every movie starring Bill Paxton I've ever seen. That know-it-all jock asshole guffaw that is not truly a laugh, but a warning. Don't fuck with me, and don't you ever, by God, I mean ever, question or disagree with me. You're losing your mind, young lady. I thought you said you were smart. First of all, those are horses. He points to a pasture on the side of the road where a couple of bored swayback nags stand swishing flies away with their scraggly tails. And secondly, they're behind a fence, not on the road. Hey, Mike, you hear this girl? Slither looks up from the rear view and meets my eyes. I think I see an apology in his. He turns up the radio currently playing Sympathy for the Devil by the Stones and swerves to the left, away from the horses and deeper into the woods. Flattop snakes his dirty hands up my shirt and squeezes my breast. Almost there, a few more minutes, as if I'm anxious to arrive. It occurs to me to wonder how he knows where to find Slither's friend's cabin. It also occurs to me to panic. I am nearing the end of my life. Even if I somehow survive, I will not return whole. This I know for certain. The cabin is pink, completely Pepto-Bismol pink, what my brain has deemed abysmal pink. This place looks like a child's drawing. It is the pink iced gingerbread home of Hansel and Gretel's witch, and me without my breadcrumbs. A two-story abomination, no porch, no fancy shutters, just a long nightmare as someone stood on the roof and simply dumped cans of bubblegum colored paint down the sides. Stands surrounded on three sides by forest. The front yard is filled with overgrown weeds and split in half by a two-lane drive, dirt drive set so far back from the road no passerby can see it. We park parallel to the house so that the passenger side window faces it. I don't want to die there. Trapped within Barbie's dream coffin, legs spread wide and mouth filled with orange syrup and cum. Flat Top grabs the gun from the console and stuffs it in the elastic waistband of his shorts. Come on, let's go in. He holds his hand out to me and I take it. He escorts me around the front of the car. We stop. You see how I took you this way so you couldn't see the license plate? I've thought of everything. I nod and think that if he is worried about me seeing the plate number, maybe they really are going to let me go. It's crazy if they do. I may not know their names, but I can describe them both well. In the case of Flat Top, right down to his micro penis. Slither has already gotten out and is coming back behind the house. From behind the house, he unlocks the door. Flat Top says, here, take her inside, and then takes the keys from him and heads back to where Slither just was. They've both been here before and know it well enough to know where the key is hidden. How much of this is a ruse and why bother pretending? What do I know about anything? What do they want from me? We walk in together, and I am alone with Slither for a moment. He sits in a chair in the kitchen, the room just beyond the front door. The place is old, white porcelain sink, 1950s-style fridge, and a small stove. The table is like my grandma's, yellow formica with an aluminum trim. I think about grandma's old fridge. It had this weird short in it. If you stood with the door open and touched the metal trim of her counter, a current of electricity would zip through you. I imagine walking over to the refrigerator and offering to get Slither a beer. I'll keep the door open and hold it out to him. When he grabs it, I'll pass the jolt to him. But here, in this place, the jolt is deadly. We'll both probably die, but I'll still be free. Instead, I stand paralyzed, unable to move. I am in the place of my death, but I cannot help myself. I'm still just a child. Come here. He holds his arms out to me. He doesn't have the gun. I go to him. I'm so afraid to tell him. His eyes seem kind. I don't want to touch him, though. He is greasy and dirty, and what teeth he has left are decaying. We won't hurt you. You just have to do what we say. My friend, he can get a little crazy, so it's real important that you do whatever he tells you to do. He pulls me down onto his lap and holds me against his chest. I don't want you to get hurt. I don't want to have to hurt you. You just keep being sweet, okay? I nod against his chest, using exaggerated movements so he can feel me agree. I will be sweet. I'm a good girl. We sit like this for what seems like forever. Long enough that I can start to identify the different smells attached to Slither. Cigarettes, sweat, that thick, bloggy smell of a body that hasn't been washed for a long time, and blood. But that can't be right, can it? Blood? Maybe it's my fear or something. I've read enough horror books to know that there is some scent to fear. I've just been fortunate enough to not to have ever smelled it. Must be fear, not blood. Hey, Flat Top is back. What's all this about? You two start the party without me? Slither eases up on the pressure holding me against him. Nah, we were just getting to know each other is all. Oh yeah? What did you learn? He pulls me off Slither's lap. Huh? What did you learn about my buddy here? What did he tell you about this place? Slither stands up. Nothing. I didn't tell her anything, so how about shutting up? They stare each other down for a minute. Finally, Flat Top laughs. Good deal. Let's give her the tour then. What's up there? Don't want to take up too much time.
You're fine.
So I wanted to ask something. So there's a point in the book where I don't want to spoil anything, but we sort of learned that the kidnappers have their own kind of traumas as well. And even Josie says at one point, she doesn't want to feel sorry for them. So I don't know. I don't know if that really was something with the real kidnappers that was with them, or you just made it up for the story, but was there any worry that you wanted to play them in some sort of weird sympathetic role at all, even though, you know, they're doing horrible stuff, but there's still something happened to them as well. Does that make sense what I'm trying to ask?
So It absolutely makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. So I guess this is, so I'll tell you what I was thinking at the time I wrote it. And then I'll tell you kind of how I've come to think of it now, because, so when I wrote it, first off, when it happened to me and they ended up in jail, I dealt with a lot of guilt that somehow it was my fault. Like, I had ruined their life. I was the one who put them in jail. If I hadn't spoke up, if I hadn't told anybody, they would be fine. And so I had this weird sort of guilt complex. Like, did I lead them on? Did I make them think I wanted to be there? And, you know, my mom and I had, you know, two counselors, and they had to work really, really hard with me for a while on that. So I sort of wanted to kind of work in that sort of feel of that ambiguous sympathy. Like, is it okay? Should I be feeling this? So I wanted to work that in. And then there really was a point at which one of the detectives, after they were both arrested, had come to talk to me and said, did I feel at any point there might have been some kind of relationship between the two? Did I feel that there was something else there, or did they say and I was just dumbfounded with it. No, I not that I had noticed. And he said it was because that they both really seemed very concerned about the other one, and they were requesting that they be put in the same jail, and they wanted to be on the same in the same part of the, I don't know what it's called, but the same segment in the jail. They wanted to be together. Uh-huh. They didn't want to be separated. And so he was like, I was just trying to understand, you know, what happened, what was their mindset, you know, was there something going on with, did they have a relationship too between them? And so it took me a while too, as a 17-year-old girl, to kind of come to terms with that. Like, well, if that's the case, if they just wanted to be with each other, why did I have to be involved? Like, why did they have to come and get me? Like, why did I need to be there? And, you know, It was this whole, well, maybe it was they didn't want to feel that about themselves, and so it was easier to be together if it was a threesome, you know, kind of a thing. And so there is a lot of emotions that hit me in the weirdest ways. Like, they didn't even want me, you know what I mean? It's so stupid to say it, like, right, yeah. They didn't even want me sexually, they just wanted to, I was you, you know, like, of course you were, but like, as a girl, as at that, it was this weird thing, like, already not sure how I felt anymore about my body, and then knowing that maybe I was just used, I didn't even need to be, I don't know, it was this really confusing time for me. But after I wrote it and like looked at it, and I worried about that too, like, are people going to think it's weird that I put this sort of sympathetic backstory to them? But I thought, you know what? I don't think so, because I think ultimately the message here is that there are two ways when you've been traumatized, when you've been abused, there are sort of two outcomes, you know, two generalized outcomes. You can become the abuser yourself and just sort of continue the vicious cycle and continue to do these horrible things, or you can rise above and try to help others and be this better person from it. And so I think putting both of our stories in there kind of shows both ways it can end up, I guess, if you've been traumatized.
The fork in the road, you can go either way.
Right. So after I did it, and I was really struggling with, will people think I'm trying to give them sympathy? Then I was like, well, wait a minute. No, I think it's okay. And that's kind of how I came to terms with leaving it there. Because I was like, yeah, because you can end up, you can continue the cycle of abuse, or you can stop and rise above. And so that's the two roads in this book.
And you see that a lot, like, basically with any serial killer, like, they go on their backstory and they're always abused as a kid, or, you know, something that bad has happened to them in their past. So yeah, I see that now.
Yep.
Was there anything major that you went back and forth as far as keeping into the book, or finally taking it out, or did we get everything that you set out for the book to be?
No, I think everything that I said, I mean, there was one point that I had the discussion with the publisher on the actual big rape scene, when they take her upstairs and that scene, which is pretty graphic and pretty intense, that entire chapter. And there was a question back and forth, was do you want to maybe cut a little of that out? Do you want to you want to like maybe make it into smaller segments that are easier to sort of digest? And I kind of stood my ground on that. I was like, no, this was that afternoon is burned in my memory, like a brand in my brain. Like, it was really important to have that horrible, painful moment be laid out exactly as it happened. And the feelings I felt, and that feeling that I was having maggots poured over me, all those things that I put are exactly, I needed, that had to be there. It just had to be there. That happened to me. That is unchanged. That happened exactly as I wrote it. And it just, I needed it to be there. I couldn't change that. And so I know that's a rough chapter, and I know that's a really like hardcore read for a few pages, but I needed it to be there.
Well, I was going to say, I think the book overall is tastefully done, because like I've outspoken before about some extreme horror books, you know, that glamorizes some of these situations. And to me, that's not entertaining. Mm-hmm. You know, like I've stopped reading books in the middle because something like this happens. But this is totally different. This is far from being any kind of extreme horror. You know, like we said at the top of the show, it's like more of a retelling, whatever term Brad used over there, the technical term for it. So
speculative.
This was able to stay within and finish to the end. You know, I didn't look at it as someone who's writing some kind of extreme story that used, you know, sexual assault or any kind of abuse for entertainment purposes. You know what I mean? And I don't read those, and I don't like.
Yeah, that. I don't either.
I've spoken out about that before, because I'm not really big. Mm-hmm. Like, when they try to one up themselves, you know, and that's just teetering on just being over top extreme, and. Mm-hmm. The way they do that is they go with sexual abuse or sexual assault, where this is totally different. So I was able to actually stay with this. That's why I'm saying it's tastefully done. You know, it's a retelling of the story. And again, you're not Josie in the story. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
And like, it was a weird mix, because I did feel like it was extreme, but not extreme like other extreme books are at the same time. It's because it is graphic, and you know, bad things are happening, but it's not like you're not trying to embellish it or exploitate anything. Or
that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. So it is. Yeah, no. I guess quote unquote, it's not extreme. You know, like in a splatterpunk award or anything like that. But it is extreme material you're talking about, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I agree. I hate that too. I hate that exploitative sexual assault, because it's always and it's graphic in a almost a hustler sort of way. You know, and I didn't want that, but also I just felt like that chapter is the reason that I did it in the first place. That's the thing that has stayed with me, you know, that's the thing that has affected my life, that moment in my life. And it just felt like, what if I don't put that in the book, then what am I even doing? Like, what am I even trying to tell? You know, if I censored that, the hard part, then I really didn't do what I set out to do. So I did, I didn't want it to be exploitative. I didn't want to use these gross words. And, you know, I tried really hard to kind of, I appreciate what you say, because that's really what I wanted to do. I didn't want people to be like, oh my God, you know, I also recognize that that's a really tough scene and a tough read, but also try not to make it too gross.
Yeah. It's a very uncomfortable, like, I don't want to say the book is entertaining, cause that just sounds like the wrong word to use, but I enjoyed the book, which also sounds really weird to say.
Yeah, I know.
But it's a very uncomfortable book, but it's very well done. It's a very powerful read, I think is a better word to say than fun or entertaining. Even though it was a good, I enjoyed it, but it's weird to say you enjoy it. Like, this is going to be a really hard book to review, because it's all, you know, based on your true experiences. And then I don't want to say, oh, it's a fun, great book. You should go check it out, because that just feels weird to say like that.
I think I've been writing my review for it for like 2 weeks now. So
yeah,
it's all right. It's okay. I know. I the same thing. Like when I've been signing and sending some out to people, and I'm like, it's on the way. I hope you enjoy it. And then I was like, or not. Like I, what do you say? Like you feel like, I hope you love it. I hope you can finish it.
I know it's kind of hard to market it a little bit, you know. Hey, check out this new book. You know what I mean?
I know. It's horrible. Yeah, I know. It's okay, because like I don't know. I just put it out there, and I really didn't know how it would go over. I really had no idea if it would be, you know, accepted or hated, or I had no idea. But it was okay, because it was my catharsis, and it did what it needed to do for me. And you know, I'm super proud that people are sending me, like, I just get messages, and instead of I've gotten messages where like it starts like this: I was 15. They just tell me their story. They not like, I read your book, just this, it was the middle of winter and it was a holiday party, and you know, they just go into their stories and they share them with me, and it's beautiful and wonderful that they feel like they can open up, and we, you know, we share that moment together, and it's just this amazing bonding moment. So if that's all that ever came of this, you know, just a couple messages from people that are like, that spoke to me and let me tell you what happened to me, then I'm super thrilled. And I feel way better. Like, it's out of me, and I feel better. Like, I feel like I was able to completely dissociate, right? It's Josie's story now. It's not Evie's, it's Josie's. Right. And so it's sort of this ability to kind of let it go. And so it did what it needed to do. And I'm just so thrilled that people are getting it and understanding it, like what you guys are saying. And I'm super thrilled that people are understanding what I tried to do. So I couldn't be happier.
Yeah. I think that instead of saying it's entertaining or fun, like, I hope you get something out of it, I think is what I'm going to say. Because, you know, people can take it different ways. And like you said, you've already gotten messages from people where they're relating, and you have that special bond with them now that, you know, that's a very powerful thing to be able to create that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of created like a helpline for them to allow them to kind of
like a safe space.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you have other books that we want to talk about, but you want to try this tarot game that Brad created here. Yeah, let's see how bad we do on this game.
Yeah, let's do it.
So Jay, I dubbed over our little intro for it this time. Okay. Since I didn't do it last week, I put my voice in there this time.
Okay.
Tarot trivia.
What was that? Love
it. I had to whisper. I don't know. It just felt right to whisper for that.
It does.
It did. Okay. It's good. It's perfect. Well,
he didn't tell me that. He didn't tell me this game or anything. He kept this one a secret from me. So
no, I didn't. What's going on? It's all in the Paper Cuts email, Jay. You just don't read them.
I gotta be signed in. I know. I saw you guys were going back and forth. I just didn't jump in. I was busy. So
I've got 10 trivia questions about tarot. They're all multiple choice. So hopefully this will be a bit easier.
That's good.
All right. So number one, tarot probably originated in which area? China, Europe, or South America?
I'm sorry.
Do I need to repeat it? Did I drop off?
All the foils, yeah.
So tarot probably originated. Tarot probably originated in which area? China, Europe, or South America?
How do we do it? Do we just throw our answers out?
Yeah.
Or do we take turns?
Just. You go. This is all for you.
Yeah. Okay. So
I think the lag is going
to
mess us up.
Have, like, or lag the gas. So sorry. I'm going to say Europe, because I've read that it had like Italian roots and Italy. So it's probably China, but I'm going to say Europe.
It's Europe. It says Northern Italy probably spawned the first cards.
Okay, cool.
All right, number two. How many cards are typically featured in a tarot deck? 52, 61, or 78?
78.
78. That's correct. It says there's no standard number for a tarot deck, but most of them are 78 cards. What is the seventh card in the major arcana? The Chariot, the Emperor, or the Wheel of Fortune?
I think...
This is probably the hardest question on here.
Yeah. I'm trying to think because I've looked at those books like a million times. I'm going to say the Chariot.
The Chariot's correct. It says it's also sometimes called Victory or the Centurion. So I guess it goes by different names.
You're on fire.
She's 100% so far.
I was so panicked. I was like, oh my God, I can't read tarot.
I just totally jinxed it for you.
Yeah, you did. The next one's going to be like...
Okay. All right, so tarot emerged in Europe in the middle of which century? The 13th, 14th, or 15th century?
Fifteenth,
correct. Man, she's killing it.
I was thinking of 15th. I don't know 15th. Why, but it was just a guess.
Which card may strongly suggest that you are living in fear or domination? The Devil, the Hanged Man, or the Emperor?
Oof.
Which card may strongly suggest that you are living in fear or domination? The Devil, the Hanged Man, or the Emperor?
I'm not sure on this one. I'm gonna say the Devil.
The Devil. She's 100% so far straight.
Oh my God.
It says that the Devil card may signify that your life will be better if you learn to let go. The first condemnation of tarot was based on the card's ties to what? Its ties to gambling, drinking, or occultism?
Well, I'm going to say occultism, but that's probably not it. I don't know.
Is that too obvious?
It seems too obvious, right?
It was ties to gambling, which just sounds weird.
Gambling?
Yeah. Gambling, yeah. Which I would have totally thought occultism.
The pentacles were coins. I would too, but yeah, I guess maybe because they're coins, maybe because like that's a so the pentacles can be coins, they can be discs, so maybe the coins. Uh-huh. I don't know. Interesting gambling.
If the moon appears in your present, you should be wary of what? Of danger, deception, or physical pleasures?
Why would you be weary of physical pleasures?
I don't know.
That's what? I'll say deception.
Deception, yep. It says your reader may warn you of people who wish to con you if you get the moon card. Hmm. Pentacles often refer to which suit? To cups, coins, or swords?
Coins.
Oh, yeah, she just said that.
She got that. I did say
that. Ha! Look at me!
Many of those cards might be marked with a pentagram, so I guess that's where the pentacles comes from.
Yeah.
And then final two questions. Tarot is often associated with which subculture? With New Age, Christianity, or Hinduism?
It's New Age, I would say.
New Age. Yeah, that's correct. Like, the New Age movement was all the rage in the 70s and 80s. Which you have another book, I think, takes place in the 70s, right? Is this one in the 70s?
I do. I have, yeah, that one's in the 70s. Well, that one is based on a cult from the 70s. It kind of takes place in the present, but uh-huh. The present is affected by what the cult from the 70s did. Yeah. And I have a novella called Dead Eyes that took place in the 80s.
Nice.
You know, homage to the VHS slasher films of the 80s. So,
those are the best. Those are the best slasher films, the 80s ones.
Right, I know, right? The final question. I remember going down to like the little corner store.
Oh yeah. Sorry. I miss Blockbuster. We talked about that last time.
You know, I miss going to the video stores and picking it up. Hanging out.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's just it's just not the same scrolling through Netflix.
It isn't. It isn't.
All right. The final question. This one I thought was this one was appropriate, I thought. Which card is often associated with abrupt, harmful life changes? The moon, the tower, or the world?
The tower.
The tower. The card often represents crisis or hazards. Yeah. I thought it was a good one to end on.
The tie-in.
That's cool.
Tie-in. Nice. She got 9 out of 10, Jay, and she told me, she's like, I don't know anything about tarot.
Yeah.
I was worried you'd be like, what does this card mean? What's that card? I'm like,
there were some of them. Those like,
ones from my stuff.
There were some that was like gibberish. I was like, I don't know, have any idea what it's talking about.
You did good. Tarot lovers.
For someone that didn't know anything about tarot, you got 9 out of 10. That's good.
I was stressed. You stressed me out for nothing.
That's a lot higher success rate. Normally, our game.
Yeah. First of all, nobody should ever stress out about this show. Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, this is not a show to stress out about. Like...
Yeah.
Normally, our games don't go that well. They're like, I have no idea what you're talking about, and it just flops hard every time.
Those were good questions, though.
So, talking about some of your other books. So, The Children of Demeter, this was your sophomore book. Are you a fan of cults and things like that? Does that interest you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love it. I love it. Like, it's the idea of the the mass buy-in to something that seems from an outsider so absurd. Right? And like, how in the world did you get so many people to buy into this idea? And it just fascinates me. Culty. That actually started with, again, like I told you, I really wanted to haunted something, and I was really sort of recommended because I wanted to write a haunted house story, and then I started thinking the house sort of like be almost like a haunted house, be a room that changes the person into something, you turn into something else, like it's changing the people, it's sort of evolving or devolving because the house is changing you as you're inside it, and that's kind of where that idea came from. And then this idea of the cult and the fertile grounds and that kind of thing, and the earth kind of taking back the cult members and sort of devolving them into something that it could control better.
That was a trippy story, by the way.
And again, a goddess, because I love my goddess. Thanks. Yeah. Thank you. I really wanted it to be super trippy. And then, you know, and I really like goddesses too, because I think it's cool to have these badass female beings. And so, Demeter, you know, this angry goddess, because you quit worshiping her appropriately. And so she got everybody back. So, that's how, it definitely evolved into something else. But
I love the cover like on this. Story. Did you,
Lynn,
did you have any say
Lynn Hansen
in the cover?
I knew I wanted it to be a psychedelic look, like, you know, like the Woodstock posters.
Yeah.
And that's really what I told her. Yeah. And that's what I told her. So I just took a bunch of you know, all those psychedelic poster art from the 60s and 70s. And I just sent her a bunch and I was like, I want something like this, like real, like nature-y. And then she just knocked it out of the park. Like that cover is I love it so much.
I feel like I need to put it on my wall with a black light.
I know. Right. Like gorgeous.
Right.
She does have. Might... Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. She probably has a big version of it. Yeah.
She does. You can, where, you see Lynn Hansen, she goes to a lot of cons, and she, mm-hmm. I have a poster size version of it that I bought from her. So yeah, so
you need to get her to do the cover for your Dracula book, because she just did like the 125th anniversary cover of the Dracula reprint or whatever.
She did. I know. I'm gonna hit her up. You know, as soon as I get the damn thing finished, I will. I absolutely am. I already love her. Like, I love her and I love her art. And when she told me she was doing art for the Dracula, I was like, oh, Lynn, like, I'm reading this too. So I'm totally gonna hit her up. I hope she hears this. And then she called
we're
her
just send it to her.
She has to.
We're just send her the video. Yeah. This video. Hey, watch this about the hour.
No, like everybody's expecting you to. You know? Right.
Now you're obligated to do it. So.
Like now, yeah, exactly. Everybody thinks it's a great idea. So
now you have to do it. So, are covers important to you? Because all your covers are, they're all different looking, but they're all great. Like I love this one. The Fourth Horror is a great cover.
Mm-hmm.
Is this Daniel Sarah? Looks like Daniel Sarah.
Yeah, and it is.
Lynn Hansen.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
So is cover art important to you for your books?
It is. It's really important to me. I'm really lucky to work with publishers that let me have some say, you know, some do. But to really let me have some say and get to look beforehand and give any feedback. And then have amazing artists as well. Everybody has been really cool about that, and I have a bunch of books on my shelf that, you know, we all have our TBR power, you know, pile that we're like, I'm never going to get to all of these, and then you go to the store and you're walking past one and you see it catches your eye, right?
Yeah,
and you're like, I'm going to buy that. I don't even know, you know, I probably never read it, but that.
Oh no, Jay, you kicked her out again. You have the Fourth Horror too, right?
I've had the ebook of it. I have a physical copy of Children of Demeter.
Do you? I'm curious how many words this one is.
It's longer. I think it's the novel.
Yeah, it's 200 pages.
Sorry.
But the font is so tiny.
It is. It's a little over, I want to say it was 100 and 120,000, because I know I worked hard to try to get it down for them because we wanted it a little less, but that's a complicated read.
Yeah.
complicated story to write, so it was hard to like.
Was the font size a choice to make it a certain page length to make it better, I guess, printing or whatever?
Thanks. Yeah. I think it was the printer that needed to be so many, it could only be so many pages to do it. So that's why.
What was it like for you to get? Yeah. What was it like for you to get nominated for a Stoker from your first book, for your first novel?
She won it.
I know she did. She got nominated and she won it.
Yeah.
It was like, surreal, because when I decided I wanted to write horror, I got involved with the HWA through Mike Arnzen, and mm-hmm. He's like, you should start coming to the HWA. So I went to the one, and I went to the awards ceremony, and I saw that haunted house statue, and I was like, I want that. Like, I want that really, really bad. And then to get the nomination for my debut, I was just like, there's no way is that gonna happen. Like, no. And then I was like convinced that somehow, you know, Arnzen had done something, you know, to get it for me. Like, you know, I convinced myself that it had nothing to do with my, you know, the book itself. It was just, he knew how bad I wanted that haunted house or something. My husband kept going, I don't think so. I mean, like, he's pretty cool, but I don't think he'd do that. Like, I don't think he's got that much pool. And But
so think you thinking to yourself, you didn't really earn it. Your buddy was just.
I really did. I was like, well, they all liked, you know, I showed up and I was fangirling the first year I went, you know, I was fangirling everybody. So everybody was like, oh, remember her. We should give her one. You know, I had myself convinced, like, that whole imposter syndrome thing. But I guess, you know, I don't know.
So was this the first thing you ever wrote? I know it was your first published debut, but was this the first thing you actually ever wrote?
Mm-hmm.
Damn. Yeah. Killing it.
So winning the Stoker for the fourth whore, were the first three whores jealous about this? or what happened to them? And are they pissed about this?
Yeah. You know what?
Who, I don't know how to answer that. I mean,
I know. I was like, I don't know. No, they were. They all played a role in.
Read the book. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. Read the book. They all have their role. They all play their role to get us there.
Jay's been holding on to that joke for as long as we knew you were going to be on the show. He's like, I want to say this. He's been holding that joke for so long.
I have not. Stop it. Maybe the next day.
Yeah, it's okay. It's quite the title.
It is.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's a good title, and like I said, the cover is like, I want to pick that up because what's this about? So if someone was new to your work and had never read anything by you before, what would you suggest a place to be for them to start? Would you suggest 3 days in a Pink Tower or something different?
You know what? I usually tell people, to start with, first of all, like, I don't know if you've read The Fourth Whore, but
I've not read it yet.
It can be very divisive. I mean, there's definitely some political stuff to it. There's mm-hmm. definitely some, you know, like, there's a lot of biblical stuff. The fourth whore, really, it was a play on the four horsemen of the apocalypse, right? So the four whores of the apocalypse. So sometimes I read the room, you know, like, this person probably not going to go for this kind of stuff. So it's the Children of Demeter, because I feel like it's a middle ground. You know,
is that the safe one?
It's not really hardcore. It's the safe, right? It's the safe one. It's horror, but it's not like hardcore horror. It's not like overly offensive in any way.
I know, it's just kind of right down the middle ground.
And then like that, then I say, okay, well, you know, if you are okay with like really gory, horrible, crazy stuff, then go ahead with the fourth horror, because that's pretty intense. But you know, and then the novellas are all just like, I think they're safe too, but I just always say Children of Demeter is my, you know, it's a good beginner Evie Knight book.
And KOTOR is a good place to start for anybody. Everybody likes KOTOR.
Yeah, exactly.
It's exactly. Weird because people get drawn into it like a real cult. They get drawn into it. So.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I want them to. So good. Yeah.
With your books, because, you know, you have different subject matters. Do you do a lot of research for your stuff, like for the fourth horror, researching the apocalypse, the four horsemen, and researching mm-hmm. cults for Children of Demeter and stuff?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do. Like, I do so much that sometimes I get lost in it and it takes a lot longer. But I like, I love history, and I love esoteric type stuff. And, mm-hmm. It's just really easy to fall, you know, if it's something that interests me, like cults, it's really easy to like, I just like need to immerse myself in it. Like, I'll watch documentaries on cults for days and days and days and just really take notes and like, because I really, really like to have as much realism and realistic mm-hmm. like background to my stories to make them feel, mm-hmm. I think, more possible. So yeah, I do tend to do a lot of it. Plus I just love research. I really enjoy it. So it's easy for me to do. Plus it's a great way to procrastinate from writing.
We hear that a lot actually from writers.
Like, it's like, right? Like it, it's true.
Like they get so deep into the research.
Well, I am writing technically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are
you can tell yourself you're doing something, you know what I mean? It's working.
What are you currently working on now? Because we talked about the Dracula thing you kind of been working on for a while, but is there anything else mm-hmm. you're currently working on?
Mm-hmm. So I wrote the short story coming in anthology. I know a producer who had a putting together a series sort of treatment uh-huh. to send to Netflix or HBO. So that's kind of the project. He thought that might be a really good series. So I'm working on that, and then I'm going to send it to him and see what he thinks. So.
Wow. We're hearing that a lot more these days.
Netflix and HBO.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think the streaming thing is they're becoming more cinematic and you know, and people I think buy into the world so much that they don't want just one show or one movie. And that's what he said, like the series are becoming the thing to do now versus film. And I'm hopeful that I can put something together that will sell. So
are you going to actually be writing like the screenplay for that or just like the sort of the core idea of it?
So I guess it just depends. Like I would love to write, I would hope that they would let me write this screenplay, but for now, you know, the core idea and get somebody on board to purchase it. And then hopefully I can ask to do the screenplay and they'll let me.
We've talked to a lot of authors too that are starting to get into screenplays, or they either started doing screenplays and switched over to writing prose or, you know, vice versa. Has it been anything you've dabbled in before, writing screenplays at all?
No, it's not even something I ever wanted to do. Like, no. And so when he said that, I was like, oh, okay. So I'm trying to learn because it's so different, you know, it's really, it's way different. Like, it seems super easy because it's just you don't have to like, you know, it's just the dialogue and then a quick action thing, which seems easy, but like, I like to talk. So I'm like writing these big, long descriptions and sees, he's like, no, cut all that. Like, no.
You lose the control with it because you can't go in depth on how you want it. You can't add the narrative to it. So it's just.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's where I'm at right now with it. Like, so it's like a struggle. How exciting would it be to write like a TV series, but also is this where I want my career to go? Like, is, because if I do that, then, you know, wouldn't that open the door to more? And so what do I want to do, you know? And I feel like I have to make a decision, but I just want to see, like, I'm having fun with it. I'm having fun with the Dracula. Those are my two things that I'm working on right now. So we'll see. Maybe we'll throw them out at the same time. And whichever one does better, that's my answer from the universe, right?
Yeah, I think doing a script would be a little bit more hectic because now you're going to be on a timeline for what the studio wants, you know, whereas writing a book.
Right.
You could take a year if you want.
Yeah, it's my time. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, which is what I'm doing with the Dracula, unfortunately. But yeah, so I know. And I think about that too. Like, could I handle that kind of like in my face? So I don't know. I'll put it together. I'll see what happens. And if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. That's what I believe. Like, I had an opportunity, so I got to see, you know, I just have to see. So
that's a cool opportunity too. Cause a lot of people write forever. They don't get an opportunity like that. So take advantage of it while you have it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and if it's meant to be, it will be. That's what I have to believe. So.
So as we start winding things down,
maybe I'll just pull a couple tarot cards.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. Or that could be the show right there.
You learn about tarot cards somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we don't want to take up much more of your Friday night, so we know you have to go out in that haunted town of yours and do some research.
Watch the banana baseball team.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Get that checked
out.
How
bananas are doing. Yeah. Yeah.
So as we start winding down here, where can people find you aside from, you know, camping out in front of your house? You're on socials, right? Twitter, Instagram, all that fun stuff.
That sounds crazy, but also it would be so cool. Can you imagine like how cool it would be to like have fans camping? That'd be cool for a minute.
You're the first author that we've had that said that.
I know. I usually end the shows that way, but most of the time they're like do the cringe laughter, you know, because they don't want people outside their house. But yeah, I mean, if you're welcoming people,
man,
I mean, you're already in a haunted town. So.
Oh my god, that would be so cool. Right? Yeah. Hang out. Come hang out my lawn and hold up like we love you, Evie. That's okay. But now I forgot the original question. What was your socials, Twitter, Instagram,
all that stuff, where people can find you.
Oh yeah. So at Evie Knight Author on Twitter. Okay. On I think Instagram. I think that's my handle on Instagram too. And then Facebook. And then evieknightauthor.com is my website. So, yeah.
I think I should have all those in the description too. There you go. Just camp out and hang out.
Okay.
Yeah. This has been fun.
Hang out with me.
This has been fun. We'll have to have you back, especially when you do the Dracula, all the Dracula stuff. Yeah. So we can dive into that.
Yeah.
But
that would be fun.
I've had a blast, you know, talking to you tonight, and a lot of interesting stories. So we really appreciate you stopping by and, you know, putting up, spending your Friday nights with us. So that's going to wrap it up there, Brad.
Right? Having me, it's really fun.
Thank you. Yeah, stop by anytime, and hopefully in the future, once that Dracula stuff's done, and we'll definitely have you back and talk.
Yeah.
Until then. Thank you, everyone in the chat, for stopping by.
Yes.
Everyone. We had a handful of writers, fellow writers, stopping by the chat with
you tonight. I saw them. I saw them there. Thank you all. That was awesome. It's good to see everybody.
Thanks for everyone. Brad, any last words before we hop out of here on this Friday night?
Go pick this up. It's available now.
That's right.
It's not a fun read. It's not an entertaining read. It's very powerful.
Well, unless that's... I mean, if that's your first one, she said, get Children of Demeter first.
Okay. Right.
Okay. Buy this one and read it, and then go buy this one and read it. And then
just get the whole
thing. Go buy this one and read it. Yeah, buy them all.
Yeah, just buy them all. That's probably the easiest. Just, you know what, buy them all at once, and then you don't have to go back out.
Just put them on your shelf.
Safety.
Good night, guys. Thanks so
much.
Thank you
so much, you guys. Thank you.
Everyone in the chat. Everyone's going to watch this later. Thanks so much.
Awesome.
That's a wrap. And that's the way the cookie crumbles. Brad, this one's over with. Let's go with it. See you guys.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.
Love you, Jay.
Bye.